This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking to Professor Peter Stansky. Dr. Peter Stansky is an emeritus professor of history at Stanford University. He has published extensively on the cultural, political, and literary milieu of 20th century Britain, including The Unknown Orwell in 1972, Orwell and the Transformation, 1980, and both these books were finalists for the National Book Award. Today, he's here to talk to me about the wonderful book he published with Stanford University Press called The Socialist Patriot, George Orwell and War. Peter, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you briefly introduce yourself to our audience and tell us how you became interested in history and how you became a professor of history at Stanford University? And more importantly, how you, I'm sure you're a big fan of George Orwell. Tell us where that love came from and how this book came about.
Well, actually, in the book, I have a sort of autobiographical introduction where I try to answer that question. I came to Stanford University because they offered me a job, which is very good of them. So I didn't know where I necessarily would end up teaching and writing. But as I say in the introduction, I became interested in Orwell. I read, as you know, 1984 was tremendously successful, and it was a selection of the Book of the Month Club in the United States, and my parents were members of the Book of the Month Club. I was a senior in high school when it came out, in secondary school, and so I think I read it then. But then when I was an undergraduate at Yale, I ultimately wrote a senior essay. I've always been interested, and it's been sort of a theme in the work I do, where literature, society, politics, culture intersect. But I've always been interested in it as an historian. I'm not a literary critic. What I try and do in my work is to understand England better and use what work I do to that purpose. I've always been very interested, not connect with Britain at all, or in a sense, in the Spanish Civil War. And somehow I wrote a senior essay, senior thesis, when I was undergraduate on four Englishmen who had been involved in the Spanish Civil War. The two who were killed there, Julian Bell, Virginia Woolf's nephew, John Cornford, and then Stephen Spender, who didn't fight but was involved with the war, and then George Orwell. So I'd always been interested in Orwell, and there was a great upsurge, obviously, ever since Animal Farm in 1984, But actually, I think it was in 1952 or three, just when I was working on this, that Homage to Catalonia, his wonderful book about the Spanish Civil War, was republished. It hadn't sold well for various reasons when it was originally published. And then some years later, the project emerged about writing an expansion with my collaborator, William Abrams, writing an expansion of that book. A book appeared that was published in 1966, Journey to the Frontier, which was about Cornford and Bell. But then there was a different book about Orwell. It might or might not have been particularly biographical, and I discussed this in the thesis. It's a wonderfully complicated story. I won't go into here, but sort of rather dramatic. The difficulties with Orwell's second wife, Sonia Brownell, and what Orwell thought about biography. But it was through an interest in English society and the Spanish Civil War that initially got me interested in Orwell. And then, as you mentioned, William Abrams and I published these two books, which were never meant to be a complete biography. And the two books, the second one ends with his coming back from Spain. But in a way, it also served to unblock the biographical logjam that had taken place because of Sonia's lack of cooperation. And it was always a question of how seriously Orwell said he didn't want a biography, but Richard Rees, his literary executor, said to us that he didn't think Orwell meant that very seriously. And he, in fact, urged us to write a book about Eric Blair, which, as you know, is Orwell's real name. He never changed it. George Orwell was his writing name. So in any case, you know, and over the years, I'd written, been published in two little collections of essays, and other, you know, I've written pieces about Orwell, but then somehow there was a Orwell exhibition at the University of New Mexico, and I was asked to give a talk about it, and somehow the topic emerged that I would talk about Orwell and his relationship to war. Now, there's so much written about Orwell. Obviously, this has not been neglected, but most attention, including what I've written myself, has been to the Spanish Civil War and to the Cold War. I don't think sufficient weight, although it's not ignored, it has been given to Orwell's being influenced by the First World War, when, of course, he was an adolescent. The Second World War, if I may say so, I think the most original contribution of my short book is the discussion of those two wars.
Yeah, and you rightly called the book George Orwell and War, and that's something we'll talk about soon. It would be good if you could give us a little bit of background about George Orwell himself. He was born in India, his family, maybe his influence of his family. And I'm really interested in understanding what he meant when he said that he was of a lower upper middle class. What did he mean by that phrase?
Well, he very famously says, I'm a member of the lower upper middle class, which means that I'm a member of the upper middle class, but without money. You know, class in England is tremendously important. Sometimes Orwell is characterized as being an outsider. I think this is quite untrue. I mean, he belonged to the official classes. And his father, as you probably know, was a civil servant at not a very high level, engaged in organizing the cultivation, only legally, the cultivation by the British government of opium in India. And so Orwell he had an older sister. He was born in India, but when he was 6 or 7 months, his mother and his sister went to England, and where he went to, and they went to Henley on Thames. Also, the very interesting thing, and to me, it's a wonderful example of how quite legitimately current interests shape what we look at now. The basis for the family fortune, which was no longer existing in Orwell's by the time Orwell was there, but which gave the family its class status, was his great grandfather, Charles Blair, who was a Jamaica slave owner. So in fact, the family money came from plantations in Jamaica and from slavery. Orwell's grandfather maybe Charles Blair was his great-great-grandfather. I keep never getting it quite straight. But anyway, his grandfather was a vicar, you know, which has a, you know, fairly high on the whole class status in Britain. But his father was, I think, the 10th child and had no income. I mean, he had to earn his keep as a civil servant. And they were never particularly well off. But nevertheless, he had that class position. And that class position was, I know it was reinforced. He went on half fees to a prep school where people of his class were sent off when they were eight to these boarding schools. And of course, he wrote a very famous essay about it, about how horrible it was, which he wrote in the 1940s. It's thought, it's not absolutely sure, called Such Were the Joys. But nevertheless, and we interviewed, because she was still alive, the headmistress, whom he's very mean about, in his essay, and Mrs. Vaughan Wilkes. And she said to us, my collaborator and myself, "Oh, Eric, I tried to treat him well." She must have known about the essay, but it wasn't published in England because of her still being alive, because of libel, until after her death. Though it had been published after Orwell's death, but before her death in the United States. And in many ways, I think he received a very good education there. And but strangely enough, in Such Were the Joys, he says, "I remember the sinking of the Titanic," of course, right now in the news, more vividly than the Battle of the Marne during the First World War. So in the essay, Such Were the Joys, he doesn't, surprisingly perhaps, doesn't talk much about the war itself. But, and interestingly, it was written just before the Second World War began in a very important short essay called England, My Country, Right or Wrong. He talks about, what should one call it, the militarism of his, when he was at school, that he was a member of the cadet corps, that he had bought a rifle when he was 10. They provided an honor guard. The first 3 years of the First World War, he was in his prep school. This prep school, you know, these schools were designed, both the prep school and, of course, as we can talk about, he went on to Eton. One reason for him being accepted on half fees was that he was a bright child who would give credit to the university by earning a scholarship, which were given not on need, but on intellectual merit, but that he would win a scholarship to a prominent public school. And as you know, he ended up in 1917, the last year of the war, going to Eton. But these schools were, in many ways, they gave good education, but they also existed to train the people who went there to become the rulers not only of the state, but of the empire. And this was in Edwardian England. The empire was in trouble, the Boer War and so forth and so on. But at the same time, it was the height of imperial feeling. And so the whole, and Orwell belonged to an imperial family. and at a very low level, but nevertheless an imperial family. So my argument is that this inevitably helped shape him and gave him the patriotism of my title. And he was always intensely patriotic, you know, which is something of a word that, you know, it has ambiguous feelings. But at the same time, he was ultimately, and it was a gradual process, not an immediate project, not an immediate event. He was also a totally committed socialist.
It was you made a lot of excellent points that I wanted to ask you, but it would be great if you could kind of expand on those points. I wanted to ask about his education in Eton College. As you mentioned, this is a very elite school. But I don't think Eton College intended to want his graduates to become socialists in England, especially at that time. So can you tell us about this gradual shift to socialism? Maybe how did his education influence him later on? And especially at that time when England was at war and it was the height of, as you mentioned, the British imperialism was in a state of crisis as well. So how did this gradual shift come about?
Well, I don't think it came about. I think he didn't do very well at Eton. He didn't study very hard. There's a debate, which is sort of a tangential point, about whether he wanted to go on to university or not. And it's generally said he couldn't afford to. But I think, and his tutor advised against it, and his father was against it. But I think ways could have been found of him going to Oxford or Cambridge, I think. But anyway, that's a what-if proposition. I don't think it was particularly political. I don't think he would have been when he was at Eton. He was iconoclastic. I mean, he questioned things. You know, these were very bright cynical, and cynicism was beginning in the early years of the war. And of course, Mike Clavering and I uncovered his very first publication, which he wrote when he was a schoolboy, which was almost embarrassingly patriotic poem about how everybody should enlist. He may have been getting, he said to Cyril Connolly, who had been with him both at prep school and Eton, you know, Britain's going to emerge as a second-rate power after the war. So, I mean, I think he was having some doubts. He was never a figure of the right. But I would certainly think he was more in the center, or maybe didn't think that much about politics when he was a young man. And of course, as you know, he became a police officer in Burma for 5 years. And when he came back to England in 1927, again, it said he left the police, then he'd become anti-imperialist. I think it's more accurate to say he was having doubts about imperialism. But his main motivation, and I think Orwell as artist is never sufficiently emphasized, in my view, is his main motivation when he quit the police force is that he wanted to be a writer. He wanted to commit himself to be a writer. He was moving gradually to the left, but it wasn't a sudden conversion. And the same is true about his politics. I think the two things that made him more and more to the left, he wrote this book just before going to Spain for the Left Book Club, The Road to Wigan Pier, where he saw the reported on the dreadful conditions of the working class brought about by the Depression. At the same time, in this famous and indeed notorious second section of the book, he's very critical of socialists for their style and they're being eccentric and they're not being particular, being sort of, well, he's not quite patronizing the working class, but you know, there's this famous description of seeing these men in shorts and sandals and you know, sort of middle-class socialists. And he felt that middle-class socialists frequently gave socialism a bad name. But nevertheless, because of the political conditions, he's now moving to the left. And then it's socialism. But remember, Democrat, the famous phrase is, he wrote to Cyril Connolly, "I've become a democratic socialist as I understand it." But it was really the experience of Spain that and the wonders of when he went to Barcelona in December 1936, how wonderful the atmosphere was, that he saw the magnificent society, according to him, that socialism could achieve. And that's when he became a committed socialist. It's also when he became a committed anti-communist, because he saw how the Russians and the communists were destroyed, in his view, correctly, of course, were destroying socialism. And that's why, of course, he's sometimes, you know, I characterize him, which is perhaps both unusual, he's both a premature anti-fascist and he's a premature anti-communist. And one reason that homage to Catalonia did so badly and wasn't reviewed very much is that it took an anti-communist line. And the majority opinion in England, who were in favor of the Republic, was sympathetic. They weren't necessarily communists, but they were sympathetic to the communists trying to win the communists supporting the government, the Spanish government.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And speaking of socialism, how did he define democratic socialism? And you mentioned that his involvement in the Spanish Civil War had an impact on this transition and an impact on his political beliefs. So, and he obviously, again, as you mentioned, he was not a big fan of Soviet Union, Russia at all. And he always, I think he also in the preface to Animal Farm, I guess he once wrote that nothing has hurt the idea of socialism more than believing that Russia is a socialist country. Can you talk about his idea of democratic socialism and the impact of the Spanish Civil War on the development of his thought?
I don't think he wasn't a theorist. He wasn't a plan maker. In a way, during the Second World War, we can talk about it. He wrote this extremely important pamphlet, which is getting attention, but maybe not as much attention as it should have. And it's wonderful. The title, The Lion and the Unicorn, which, of course, are the heraldic beasts that support the royal coat of arms. And then the second, the after the colon, Socialism and the English Genius, and which he argued, erroneously as it turned out, that in order to win the war, Britain would have to become a socialist society. As I say, as far as I know, he never really outlined a program. But he didn't believe, you know, the classic Marxist term is, you know, I'm not a Marxist scholar, you know, taking over the means of production. I mean, the state running more and more things and the elimination to a considerable degree of private property, the capping of incomes, the elimination of the capitalist class, the egalitarian. What he wanted was what he felt was the egalitarianism of that he found in Barcelona. Tipping had been abolished. Señor had been abolished. It's a psychological. I mean, I don't think he was not a planner. I mean, he didn't have specifics, but his belief that if the working class weren't financially oppressed, that common decency would triumph. I mean, I think in a way, maybe he was a bit unrealistic. Well, he wasn't unrealistic in that, you know, again, we can talk more about it. He recognizes the great enemy of socialism, power. And of course, that's the great marvel of Animal Farm, but also of 1984, that the pigs, although perhaps with some defects to begin with, but to begin with, they established a socialist society. But then they were so determined to keep power that it transformed itself into a totalitarian society. And he thought, you know, and I think he's right, but it is not likely to happen, that the only way that a socialist society can preserve itself wasn't ideological, but rather that those in control had to continually change. And the trouble is that those who make the revolution, who may start out with commendable ideals, nevertheless, power, and, you know, the famous, as far as I know, never refers to it, but there's this, the famous slogan or remark by Lord Acton, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And Orwell profoundly believed that, and that the only way that socialism could be preserved, if the leaders of the state, the people who were running it, changed frequently. Other than Barcelona, where his feelings about Barcelona when he arrived there, as I say, he does, and just as it's the comradeship. There's the famous essay that he wrote looking back on the Spanish Civil War, where he shakes hands with the Italian militiaman who's in the same group. He says, "Nothing shatters the crystal spirit." So it's that socialism, according to him, and, you know, maybe he's overly idealistic, produces comradeship. And also, you know, I haven't really thought that much about it. There's a personal driving in it, in that he wanted to be, again, it's the ironies of what happens in British society. He wanted to be more with the working class. And the Road to Wigan-Pier has a wonderful description, a rather romanticized description of a working class family sitting around the fire. But the irony, of course, was when he was tramping, which he didn't really need to do for financial reasons. He was really doing it in order to find material to write about. He was taken, in a sense, accurately, as an Etonian down on his luck. And, you know, he kept up Etonians. Well, Cyril Connolly didn't realize at first that George Orwell was his old friend Eric Blair, but Etonians, Richard Rees was an Etonian, David Astor, who employed him on the Observer, was an Etonian. So in some senses, he did profit from L.H. Myers, who gave him the money to take his health restoring after the Spanish Civil War, a visit to Morocco. Was an Etonian. So in a sense, he didn't reject his education. And actually, maybe I'm digressing too much, but in the Lion and the Unicorn, you know, he famously says, inaccurately, that the public schools will be eliminated, but England will still be England as it was. As I say, I think in the book, in many ways, he's a combination of Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine. And in fact, the public schools weren't eliminated. But again, and this isn't a particularly Orwellian thing, but it's part of the way I see whether accuracy or not, British society. In that British society, in the monarchy, which of course is now in an interesting state of its history, the monarchy is a wonderful example. In that British and the public schools are wonderful examples. That British institutions are incredibly capable of changing radically in order to stay as much the same as possible. And I think Orwellian, and of course his famous definition in The Lion and the Unicorn, in which he says Britain is a family. I don't know if he says England, but he says England is a family with the wrong people in control. Good Britain aunts, bachelor uncles.
This is one of his most famous writings, The Lion and Unicorn, Socialism and the English Genius. Why did he believe that England had to become a socialist country?
It was not as most famous. You know, I think more and more attention is being paid to it. It was in the very end, Darcy Moore just gave a talk, actually, to the Orwell Society on The Lion and the Unicorn. It was in a series called Searchlight Books that Orwell was and Tosco Fivel and Fred, well, the editors and Frederick Warburg, or Severin Warburg, his publisher, published it. And he said that in order to mobilize society efficiently and give the working class, a feeling that they're fighting for what they want, in order to win the war, Britain will have to become socialist. But he was wrong. But there's no question that Britain, the state, it moved towards socialism during the war to a certain degree, and then that it even moved closer to socialism, not quite socialism, but certainly it moved much closer to socialism with Orwell's approval in the welfare state after the war. One of the books that he published in the Searchlight series, which I write about in a book I've written called The First Day of the Blitz, in which Ritchie Calder wrote that the first day of the Blitz, September 7th, 1940, is going to be as important in British history as Bastille Day was in France, in that the state realized that it had to be more proactive. It had to cope with the Blitz, and also that it had to cope, it had to deal with everybody. Before the war, the feeling was that the state should only help the deserving poor, the worthy poor, those who somehow had better character or were in financial difficulties not through their own fault or whatever. But then the conception did grow during the war, and Orwell was part of it, that everybody, all the inhabitants of the state, have to be treated equally. And in a way, that's a definition of socialism, that the rich should not be better off or have privileges. Everybody should be at the same level, which of course hasn't happened. But I think that's an ideal of socialism that Orwell believed in. But he was never very specific. He does have a list of what he says will be true after the war, but most of them are inaccurate. You know, the House of Lords will be eliminated, but it's one of My nephew is was my sister married an Englishman, and my nephew is a member of that, a peer, life peer. The House of Lords, you know, it's much weaker than it was, but it hasn't been eliminated despite Orwell's prediction. As I say, the public schools haven't been eliminated despite public schools. The country homes haven't all become, I think he thinks they've become rest homes or something. The National Trust is a wonderful example of a British institution that allows the upper classes frequently to stay in their houses. But there have been changes, but they Orwell said that these changes will be inevitable and necessary, and in that sense, he was wrong. But nevertheless, he projects an ideal that I personally think is terrific. Not that it will ever be achieved.
And earlier you mentioned that JoJo has always been popular, but I guess in more recent, especially in the past 7 or 8 years, there has been a renewed interest in Orwell's writings, especially his fiction, 1984 and Animal Farms. And I guess part of it has to do with the rise of populist politicians around the world and in the United States. But one thing that has always kind of puzzled me was that a lot of people, right-wingers, I mean, conservatives, sort of appropriate Orwell's writings, or they say it's an Orwellian world, whereas we know that if they read some of Orwell's writings, you may not agree with them anyhow. But the question I have, why is it that a lot of conservatives or even right-wingers who constantly denigrate socialism sort of appropriate George Orwell's writings?
Well, and yes, that's true. To harp back a little to what you began with, I mean, the thing that to me, which is quite fascinating, 1984 on Animal Farm, Newsman Adler said accurately, were probably the most important cultural documents of the Cold War, and to show, you know, the evils of Orwell never wanted Russia to be overthrown, to the communist regime to be overthrown. He just wanted it not to be influential outside of Russia. And so, and Orwell said, there's this extreme danger because of the love of power of socialism being perverted. But it doesn't mean that it has to happen. And it's still, the world should be socialist. And when the right, particularly in the United States, tried to appropriate 1984, you know, and it was published months before his death, but nevertheless, he had a time to issue with Life magazine and elsewhere denials. I'm a socialist. I'm a supporter of the Labour Party, and I profoundly disagree with people saying it's a document to show that socialism is inevitably bad and evil. Continued, and you know, it's inevitable. And there are fights about this. There were fights about it in 1984, where Norman Pott Horowitz tried to co-opt Orwell to the right, and Christopher Hitchens was the figure of the left. And then, ironically, in 2003. Where Hitchens has become more conservative, he was more the Orwell of the right, and Stephen Collini and others defended Orwell of the left. But let's see. I think I'm getting away from your basic question. But I think that now, to me, it's quite wonderful and amazing. I think there are two reasons that particularly 1984. Has had this fast rise in popularity, and you know all the talk about AI is significant. I think now the Cold War aspect of it's there, of course, but it's less important. And now it's the power of the computer, and how the computer can change things and control things and rewrite the past. I think that's what's captured the imagination. And also the other thing that's wonderfully ironic is Trump has been absolutely fabulous for Orwell. And alternate facts, when his press agent or, you know, press person, you talked about alternate facts and alternate reality and so forth and so on, sales of 1984 skyrocketed. And the whole idea that you could which of course is a premise maybe the Zoom is part of it. We haven't quite gotten to the era of telescreens, but the feeling that these machines and other people know much more about us than we might wish. That sort of, well, I wouldn't say it's apolitical, but it's obviously not the same as the Cold War. That aspect of 1984, I think, is a major factor in it being so intensely popular. And Orwell, he died 70 years ago. He died in January 1950, more than 70 years ago. And he's probably better known now. Well, in the last 5 years of his life, he was very well known. But he's now probably better known than he ever was before.
Professor Peter Stansky, thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk to us about your wonderful book, The Socialist Patriot, George Orwell and the War. It's a wonderful book.
I hope it somehow will be available. If your listeners wish to purchase it, I don't think it'd be in bookstores, but I think it's on various sites. It should be available. It's a short book, but it's also at a modest price.
Yeah, it's a short book, and it's very easy to read, and it's highly informative. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for interviewing me.